You're hearing voices from NPR, the best of public radio, supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome to Portrait of a Plague. I'm Joe Richman of Radio Diaries. This is a Hearing Voices AIDS Awareness Special. These are the nurses in the AIDS ward of Baragwanath Hospital in the township of Soweto, South Africa. And this song is how they begin every morning. My family and I have been living in South Africa for the past year. As a journalist in this country, you quickly learn certain statistics. South Africa has the largest AIDS population in the world. 1 in 8 South Africans is HIV positive. That's more than 5 million people. And every day, an estimated 1,000 South Africans die of AIDS. After a while, though, numbers and facts lose their meaning. The bigger the problem grows, the harder it is to remember the individual people behind the statistics, what they look and sound like. But that's what we'll try to do this hour, in stories from Africa and from America. And that's what nurse Agnes Ramashika struggles to do every day. We met Agnes a year ago. She's an AIDS nurse and counselor at Baragwanath Hospital here in South Africa. This is the world's largest hospital. Every day more than 2,000 patients check in. Almost half are HIV positive. We start our hour with Agnes Ramashiga's story. Just another day at the biggest hospital in the world.
We are at the entrance of Baragwanath Hospital. It's a typical morning in Soweto. There is some clouds, it's not yet very hot. And it's 14 minutes to 7 o'clock. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning, ladies.
You are late today.
So, morning report. Maria in bed 5 slept well. Bed 38, Dora. She's coughing blood.
In the morning report, we hear what was happening last night.
Winnie in bed 9, she's up and about. Bed 11, Christina has diarrhea. And bed 33, unfortunately, the patient passed away at 4 a.m. this morning.
This is how we start every morning. We ask the Lord to give us strength with our daily job.
I started working here in 1989 on the 15th of January. We didn't know about AIDS then. There were not many patients who were HIV positive. But these days, because of the epidemic, there is a funeral almost every day. There are a lot of deaths that have passed my hands.
We are crossing the street, passing the laboratory area, over to ward 35. There are patients already awaiting us. I move very fast. Morning.
Baragwanath Hospital is the largest hospital in the world, and it was included in the Guinness Book of Records. We are entering ward 16.
These are all the patients. Hello, Tara.
The hospital was a military base. So when you go into the wards, the arrangement of beds, it's like a military barracks.
Is the patient here?
We don't separate AIDS patient from other medical conditions because 2/3 of patients lying in the medical wards are HIV positive. It's 5:12 now. I'm in ward 24. Okay. So
Mina Sister Agnes. Uxoxisana nomuntu ophethwe yi-HIV. I introduce myself and why I'm here. Utheni kuwe mama udoctor?
Ukhulume ngelona. Kodwa ajike wayijika le. Ebethu umzimba wamunani kanti wathi.
He says when I came to hospital, I was told my body is weak. Then today he told me that I'm positive for HIV.
It's positive. What was? Because why in the end kanjani?
After being told that he is HIV positive by the doctor, he said, no, the doctor is clowning, like joking, when he told him his results. Because he's not a person who run around with girls. We asked Mama, positive for HIV. I'm asking him, what does he understand by being HIV positive?
Very upset.
He knows that it's a killer disease. He knows that it is incurable. Kodwa once ibanga phansi kwe 200 full blown AIDS. Okay? I was explaining that once your CD4 count is 200 and below, you are termed being full blown AIDS. Awakho kusele 58. Yama? I have told him his count is only 58, which is very, very low. CD4 count drops at a rate of plus minus 50 per year, and today is 58.
Okay.
She says now he can see it's real. These news are really bad, and he is going to tell the sister-in-law. Okay, Papa. God bless. He is really very, very thin. He's like skeleton. You can see each and every bone in his body. And it's really frustrating to tell the patient that you should eat. The question is, I'm unemployed. There is no food. What can I eat? And in his condition, when I look at him, I doubt if he can be with us for 6 months. It's now 3:10. I'm in ward 24. Now it's visiting time. There are relatives around seeing their sick patients. They brought in food. It's like a family gathering. Almost every family has had a relative dying of AIDS in Soweto. Those patients whose relatives know their status, I think they are really brave. It's not easy to tell the people that you love that you have an incurable disease. It takes guts to say to a person, I am HIV positive. This is how we are being paged. If somebody is looking for us, this is what they do. The bleep will go beep, beep, beep. Mutomela Ramashinga here? Yes. What is the patient's name? Okay. Thank you, Doc. So we are entering with 16. Okay, I'm Sister Ramashega. I'm from the Counseling Services of Baragwanath. Firstly, I'd like to know, when was your sister diagnosed?
We found out last Tuesday, so we don't know how long she's been having this.
She's seriously ill?
Yes, she's very sick, but she can still walk. I was shocked. You should have told us. Maybe we could have done something, you know, help.
Okay. Always emphasize that you are there for her. Do you think you can do that?
Yeah, I can do that.
Then she will tell you when she was diagnosed. Then you educate her about the diet, about the importance of using condom now that she is infected. Okay?
I've seen news. They say that garlic helps HIV patients. If they eat garlic, they recover very, very quickly.
I personally haven't seen a patient who's doing well on garlic. I've seen patients doing well on antiretroviral treatment.
Is it for free?
No.
Not for free?
Only if the relatives or the patient can afford, can the doctor prescribe treatment.
Right now, I just don't know.
Okay. I'm here for you anytime.
Thank you.
God bless. With AIDS, you are helpless. They would love to have treatment. And it's painful telling the patient that there is something, but because you cannot afford, we cannot give you. Those who can afford will get the treatment. Those who cannot afford it, then goodbye, go and die peacefully. It's really tough.
Mama, so you will tell the sister this is number one, because I'm leaving to what, 35?
And I think that's it.
Okay.
Thank you.
I remember when I started working, I used to take everything from home. If I meet a parent who doesn't have clothes, even food at times, the leftovers, I'll bring them for the patient who do not have anything. But with time and the influx of patients, it's so huge. Eventually, I cut ties. I don't carry the burden home like before. It ends when I end here. So this is what keeps me going.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
It's 4:40 now. So I've done for the day. I'm going home. When I get home, I'm so exhausted. So I revive myself by getting into a bath and watching soap operas. This is the exit. So that's it. I'm Sister Agnes. Bye from me. I'm off to Soweto.
Agnes Ramashiga, an AIDS nurse at Baragwanath Hospital in Soweto, South Africa. A story produced by myself and Sue Johnson in 2003 for Radio Diaries and broadcast on NPR's All Things Considered. You can spend a day at the hospital with Nurse Agnes in a special web documentary at radiodiaries.org. You're hearing voices. This week, Portrait of a Plague. In 1999, American Radio Works, the documentary unit of American Public Media, presented a story called The Positive Life. Producers Stephen Smith and Stephanie Curtis gave tape recorders to three HIV-positive teenagers. We'll hear from all three over the course of this hour. First, this is Tanya's story.
Hi, my name is Tanya Torres. I'm 15 years old and I go to high school at New Smyrna Beach High. I'm a freshman and I'm HIV positive. I got it from a blood transfusion when I was born. And ever since then, my life has been just a little bit different than others.
Actually, Tanya's life is a lot different than other kids. She was gravely sick from the day of her birth, and doctors didn't diagnose her HIV disease until she was 5. All they knew was she got sick a lot.
She was in the hospital almost monthly.
That's Tanya's mom, Brenda.
They told me, actually, when she was a newborn, that she would never leave the hospital. She left the hospital when she was 3 weeks old. Then they tell you, when you find out you have AIDS, that you not to expect to make it 2 years. And she passed that, and then they told me, the experts told me not to have, she wouldn't make it to 10, and now she's 15.
And a half.
And a half. Oh, pardon me.
Hello, Amanda. Where is Yelsa? She not here today?
Scooby.
Lunchtime at Tanya's high school starts at 10:30 in the morning.
Mostly the same people sit with the same people. It's just not always in the same spot. We're not the populars and we're not the dweebs, so we're in the middle. I'm sorry, Colleen, but that sandwich looks really, really nasty.
Tanya loves her high school, especially drama class. She'd like to be an actress, but she's also taking classes to be a caterer. Tanya has a ready, mischievous smile, dark eyes, and thick, wavy brown hair. HIV slowed her growth, so she's shorter than most of the other kids her age. Tanya has a chronic and often painful disease in her legs from taking an experimental anti-AIDS drug when she was younger. So a lot of the time she rolls through the school hallways in a wheelchair, which makes her an inviting target for pranksters.
Hit me again! Just hit me again! Come on! I enjoy it!
In the socially obsessive, self-conscious world of high school, a wheelchair is unwelcome social cargo for a girl who secretly longs for romance.
Have you noticed that most songs are, like, about love and stuff? Like, this girl dumped me, or I want you back, or something like that. Have you noticed that? It's all about, like, couples and stuff. It's weird. Can this be true?
Tell me, can this be real? And I'm like,
shut up, Emmy.
I'm trying to try
she
for
had
her.
Seven people ask her out last week. Does that not make you sick?
Tanya lives with her mom in a small Florida town near Daytona Beach. On most afternoons, you can find Tanya hanging around the house with her best pal, Abby, listening to music. Abby's mission for the past several months has been to set Tanya up with a guy.
Hi, is Chris there? Okay, just tell him Abby called. Good, thank you.
He's grounded.
Oh, grounded. Even better.
Until Wednesday.
Wednesday?
Wednesday.
Does he have a crush on me?
No.
Figures. I had a feeling he didn't. Why would he? Nobody has a crush on Tanya. She's the AIDS-infected girl.
Do you think it scares boys off?
Definitely. Mm-hmm. Wheelchair, too. You'll think that scares them off? I have this big four-wheel thing that I'll run them over with. They mess with me. You think that's not going to scare them off?
That will scare them off.
Thank you. Do we have any cheese stuff, Mom? Roxy, get back out there. Roxy. Out.
So if you did go on a date, what kind of a date? What's your dream date? With
I don't have one. Right now, I'm looking for a date, period. I don't have a dream date.
She wants to go to the movies.
Yeah, the movies. That works.
So far, Abby's recruiting mission is a complete flop. The problem is, boys that Abby tries to snag for Tanya invite Abby out instead. Tanya says she's always being asked if you can get HIV from kissing. It's unlikely. And from Brenda's point of view, any kissing would be more dangerous to her daughter than to the boy because of Tanya's poor immune system.
She gets a boyfriend and he's got some kind of infection of some, you know, even a bad cold or whatever. She's going to get it if she's kissing him. That's going to happen. She catches everything.
And?
So,
I have to grow up eventually.
And you're miserable when you're sick.
Yeah,
so that's a concern for me. Not her, but me.
As the mother of a girl infected with HIV, Brenda never thought she would have the pleasure of maternal anxieties about dating and kissing. But Tanya's years of taking anti-AIDS medications have paid off. Her health is stable enough now that she doesn't have to take the drugs, and Brenda is guardedly optimistic about Tanya's future.
When she was five, it was, let's go pick out the casket and, you know, what colors and where do we want her buried and that kind of thing. And now it's, well, where does she want to go to college and what does she want to be and... will she ever be able to have children? Will that ever happen? And is she going to be able to find a husband? And that's the kind of thing she thinks about now.
There's nobody, 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 nobody that I know. Anybody I know, I would not go out with because I know them. I've known them for years.
You know what?
What?
You got a long life ahead of you, kid.
Okay.
What's the hurry?
My mom is direct, boy. Once, while drunk on maternal recognition of my maturity, I slipped on a casual reference to some collegiate bed hopping I'd done. I figured she was just Catholic, she wasn't dead, and she just looked at me. I expected some kind of maternal admonishment, you know, because she's really into that, but she just looked at me and she said, Lisa, I spent 2 weeks watching your uncle die of AIDS. Once, this nurse put a breathing tube down his throat, and she said, "Does it hurt? Are we in pain?" And he shook his head no, but when I asked him, I said, "John, are you all right? Does it hurt?" He shook his head yes, and he closed his eyes, and he went with it, because that's all that any of us could do, really. And when it looked like he was going to be on the respirator permanently, we got together as a family, and we gave him 2 weeks, and I sat there in that hospital room, and I said, "Johnny, you better pull out of it. You've got 2 weeks." 4 days, John, 2 days left until we had to let him go. And frankly, Lisa, I don't think a little piece of latex is too much to ask for the sake of your own body and your mother's peace of mind. My mom's direct, boy. That's why we're friends.
That's Lisa Buscani with her poem, Counting. And this music is from the composition And Trouble Came, An African AIDS Diary by Laura Kaminsky. It's a piece for viola, cello, piano, and narrator, and it tells the story of Tamoklo, a warrior, tailor, and AIDS victim.
"After the family turned me out, I lived like a dog," Tamoklo says with surprisingly little bitterness in his voice. "I roamed from village to village, working when I was strong enough, eating whatever I could find. I asked for nothing and expected nothing in return. You know, I was once an Asafo warrior. They are the hunters. When I was still a teenage boy, they chose me for my strength, speed, and accuracy. After I got sick, I joined the men for the annual deer hunt just after the rains finished, but I could not keep up. The men laughed and joked, 'Oh, Tamoklo, you are no longer a young boy. Your blood is thin, your legs are weak. You need the help of the herbal doctor. He's got a potion to strengthen you.' But I knew full well that there would be no herbs that would make me better. And so I remained quiet when the men joked." Tamoklo pauses, and when he continues, he offers this fervent plea. "I hope that 10 years from now, if another young man, an Asafo warrior just like me, is sick with AIDS, things will be different."
I'm Joe Richman of Radio Diaries. In the next half hour, we'll meet two more teenagers living the positive life. We'll hear some thoughts about raising the dead, a dying mother's letters to a son she'll never see, and more stories of Tamoklo with music from Laura Kaminsky's African AIDS Diary. That's in a minute when we return with Portrait of a Plague.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. From NPR, this is HearingVoices.com.
Mrs. Abba Amponsa is a bread baker who owns and operates her own clay oven in the center of the village. For the past 10 months, this gap-toothed, illiterate woman has been faithfully attending Sister Margaret's women's group. And today, sitting next to Tamoklo, her swollen baker's hands clasped firmly in her lap, Abba Amponsa tells her story. "Before I joined the ladies' group, there were certain things I did not know. I thought the entire family would get AIDS from breathing the same air as Tamoklo. Just having him around, the whole family would get sick. We were all afraid. It was my duty to tell him to go. It was a great shame for the entire family." She sighs deeply, looks at Tamoklo with tear-clouded eyes, and continues, "And it was a very great burden for me to ask him to go. Of all the men in the family, I had always cared for Tamoklo the most." She smiles in recollection. "So many evenings, when the embers burnt out in my oven, Tamoklo would come for me with a lantern and walk me back to the compound. We'd sit under the mango tree and share some palm wine. I'd tell him stories of my childhood, and we would laugh together." She stops, obviously troubled by what she is about to say. "I was wrong to have sent Tamoklo away, and I was afraid that he would not find it in his heart to forgive me. I sent his junior sister to the hospital to deliver this message. Please, Tamoklo, come home. I will care for you." She reaches over and takes his hand in hers. As he leans toward her, the light from the barred window casts a shadow across his bony face. Abba Ampansa's eyes grow dim with painful memories, and with the pain yet to come.
That's And Trouble Came, An African AIDS Diary by Laura Kaminsky. You're listening to Portrait of a Plague, a Hearing Voices AIDS Awareness special. I'm Joe Richman of Radio Diaries. We continue now with the American Radio Works story, The Positive Life, produced in 1999 by Stephen Smith and Stephanie Curtis. They gave tape recorders to HIV-positive teenagers. In this final segment, we meet Tanisha and Mark.
What?
We're going to interview you.
Tanisha made this tape with her sister and her sister's baby.
What's your baby?
Her name is... Could you stop talking about my baby, miss?
Doesn't it think it's time for you to call 1-800-JENNY-CRAIG for this baby?
Tanisha lives with her grandmother in a small house crammed with an assortment of siblings, uncles, aunts, and cousins. Tanisha doesn't want her real name used on the radio because most of the people in her Chicago school and neighborhood don't know she's HIV positive.
This is me and my sister. This is me, my mom, Duck, and Rhonda.
Tanisha's photo album shows the toll of HIV. Snapshots of family gatherings include a few relatives who started avoiding Tanisha when they found out about the disease. They kept her from holding or playing with their children. And the pictures show her mother, emaciated and exhausted, before AIDS finally killed her at age 29. Tanisha was 7.
Picture my mom and my cousin Phil.
You do look like your mom. Man. How'd your mom get HIV?
She was doing drugs, but then she didn't know that she was pregnant. So she went to the doctor. She found out. So I know if she knew she was pregnant, she wouldn't have did it.
Tanisha's grandmother is raising her now. The girl is tall and strong for her age, with long limbs and wavy black hair that tumbles down her back. Her legs are covered with the nicks and bruises that an active girl gets. For a person with HIV, her health is good. Tanisha's never gotten a life-threatening infection. And as she grows older, Tanisha's natural teenage impulse for rebellion sometimes collides with the extra protectiveness that comes naturally to adults who care for a young girl with HIV. Her grandmother says Tanisha
is a very sweet girl. She's spoiled. By the whole family. And we all love her, and she loves to have her way. And sometimes I think she can run me. And when I stop her, she gets so upset. But then she knows she got to do what mama say.
Some people say I'm a tomboy, because I be around here wrestling with the boys and stuff. My grandmother, she be so shook up. Don't do that, don't do that. I don't want you to fall and cut yourself. You know, sometimes I think my grandma just a little too unprotected of me. I told her, hey, grandma, I'm big. I'm not your kneecap size anymore. I mean, I'm almost tall as you. I'm going to be a teenager in about a couple of more weeks. And you just have to get used to me out and playing and falling.
Get down, Matthew.
Sometimes I don't like when I get a cut, my grandmother go get gloves and bleach and all that type of stuff. And, I mean, that sometimes it does offend me because she has to get all that stuff. Like, it's so dangerous. Like, if she touches, it's going to kill her when she could just wipe her hand off or something. But I understand that the virus that I have is dangerous. And I understand that she don't want it. But my grandma always tell me, you know, your blood is dangerous, your blood spilling off. I'm like, yeah, yeah, yeah. Don't put your mouth on it. Say, Bubba.
Bubba.
And I hope I don't ever get sick, and I hope I live a long time. I have a niece and nephew that I would love to grow up and see them grow up along with me. My goal is to finish high school. I want to get me a job when I get 16. And I want my grandma to start a savings account for me. And I want to get me a car. I have a birthday coming up, and I'll be 13, and I'm glad I've been living. And my doctor told me that I'm doing very good. So I thank the Lord that I wake up every morning and can walk and talk and hear, run and touch and play and feel just like everybody else.
In spite of her teenage defiance, Tanisha is actually quite careful about staying healthy. But other kids with HIV sometimes try to prove they're like everyone else by taking risks. They drink or get into drugs. Some risk the health of others by having unprotected sex. For a young woman who gets pregnant, drug therapies can reduce the risk of passing the disease to the baby from about 25% to less than 8%. But pediatric HIV specialist Catherine Samples encourages her patients in Boston to recognize the likely problems.
How will you feel if the child does turn out to have the infection? How will you feel if you're very sick and can't take care of your child? And what are your plans? Those are issues that adult people deal with also when they have HIV and decide that they're going to have children. But it's more complicated when you're a teenager and still at the age of denying that these things are ever going to happen to you. We don't ever say to a kid, this diagnosis means you can never date, you can never have a relationship, you can never have children. We talk about the pros and cons, and we talk about being available to help if their decision includes a decision to have sex or a decision to have a child.
But while the burden of a childhood with HIV compels some young people to take heedless risks, others grow up faster than their peers and seem far more cautious and thoughtful than typical teens. In a working-class neighborhood of Boston, Mark found out he is HIV positive in seventh grade. He was 12 years old. Mark is a hemophiliac. He got the disease from contaminated blood products. From the moment he found out, Mark kept the news a secret. Many young people with HIV do, even today.
I knew I was going to wait until I graduated high school to tell my friends that I was HIV positive, because I wanted to go through high school as a normal kid and not as a boy with AIDS. I didn't want to be picked on and beat up and made fun of every day because I had AIDS.
We decided not to be upfront with very many people at all.
Mark's mom, Diane.
Because if you walk up to somebody and say, oh, I have multiple sclerosis or cancer, they don't back off and treat you any differently. But when you went up to people and said, this was in your family, they didn't want to talk to you. They were so afraid they would just catch it from talking to you or drinking out of a water fountain with you. And none of that's true.
Since graduating, I said every night that I'm going to tell my friends tomorrow night. But every time that time rolled around, I chickened out. I was scared and I just backed out and I couldn't do it. I just don't want to lose friends. As I get older, new challenges come into play, such as when I'm going to college now, I'm going to have to tell my roommates that I'm HIV positive.
Danny, you're finally awake, huh? What is this, clockers? What's going on?
So I'm thinking one day, when I take my medicine, they're going to say, what's that for?
As well they might, Mark chokes down a fistful of antiviral drugs several times each day.
And then I'll just come out and say, it's because I have HIV.
I'm going to check my mail.
On campus, Mark seems like any other college guy. He listens to bands like Godsmack and Korn. He stays up too late. Then in the morning, downs a Hostess apple pie and a carton of chocolate milk for breakfast. He studies. He drives around in his car.
This is Limp Bizkit.
I guess it would be nice if I could touch your body. I know not everybody has got a body like me.
But I gotta think twice before.
Because of HIV, Mark's never really had a major girlfriend by his own choice.
As of now, I decided not to have sex. Before I even think about putting somebody at such a risk, I gotta really, really love that person. But then, if I really, really love the person that much, how could I even think about putting them at that risk? And if I were to ever give anybody HIV, you know, it's pretty much like killing somebody if I did.
My name is Natasha, and I'm one of Mark's good friends. And, okay, if you find a girl, you should... I mean, it's not necessarily like you should say, hey, I'm HIV positive, like, on the first day, you know what I mean? If you find a girl, they're a nice person, they know you from the inside and out, and then once you feel comfortable, I think you should say something before anything gets, like, you know, intimate.
What would be, like, your reaction if, like, after, like, a few dates with somebody, they told you that they were HIV positive?
I'd be like, okay, so what do we do now? You know, if it depends on how the serious, like, the relationship was going. Do you know what I mean? If it was, like, date fun, like, you're just going out, you know, you go out and kiss, whatever, you know, have a good time. But if we were planning on doing anything, then we'd have to figure stuff out along the lines of that. It wouldn't be like, oh, shoot, I gotta run away now, you know? I mean, really.
Not long ago, Mark finally told his roommates about his HIV. He says the guys seemed kind of underwhelmed about the news. Mark even made a presentation about his disease in a speech class, and no one bolted for the door. After years of concealing this significant part of his life, Mark is relieved and a little stunned that it's not such a big deal to others.
You know, when you learn that you have HIV, with the way today is, you know that you aren't going to die right away. You know that. Especially with the protease inhibitors that are coming out now, with the cocktails that they're called, mixed with all different medicines. You know, people are no longer dying with HIV. They're learning how to live with HIV. And the only thing holding people back from living with HIV is other people putting them down.
Let the loving come back to me.
This is Stephen Smith, Minnesota Public Radio.
The Positive Life was produced by Stephen Smith and Stephanie Curtis of American Radio Works, the National Documentary Unit of Minnesota Public Radio. It was mixed by Craig Thorson. Production help provided by Nancy Fuchin and Nathan Williamson. Special thanks to Joe Richmond. The program was edited by National Public Radio's Deborah George. The executive producer for American Radio Works is Bill Buesenberg. It's what I got.
There is a pharmaceutical lab at the hospital in Berricombe. It stocks a number of imported antibiotics, manufactures its own saline and glucose solutions, and dispenses anti-malarial medication as casually as gumdrops. In Ghana, malaria comes frequently, like colds or toothaches. AIDS, however, is treated only with aspirin. Sister Margaret sees that Tomoklo is growing tired. We will take our leave soon, Tomoklo. You must rest. He nods, for our visit has been long and draining. I need some more medicine for the pain, Dr. Sister. Lately it has been hard for me to sleep. Sister Margaret opens her purple knapsack and pulls out a container of aspirin, from which she counts 18 pills. Take 2 every 6 hours. I will bring you more at the end of the week. But here is something for you to enjoy now, she says, as she rummages through her cavernous bag. She hands him a bottle of schnapps. Share this with your mother-in-law. You never know what story she'll tell you after a few shots of this stuff, as she winks at Abba Amponsa. And here's something to keep you looking sharp when you go into town, she says, waving a pair of green aviator sunglasses in front of him. Wear these, and you'll glow in the dark. But do me a favor. Don't tell anyone where you got them, or I'll have to buy a case for the entire village. Thank you.
In the early 1980s, AIDS for most people meant death. But treatments improved, and now people have been living for decades with HIV. So what's that like, being brought back from the dead? Arthur Crandall Krauss wondered about this, imagining what it was like when Jesus revived Lazarus, his dead friend. Krauss and his partner, Paul Borja, wrote the book, It's Never About What It's About, What We Learned About Living While Waiting to Die.
Do you ever wonder what Lazarus did after he was raised from the dead? Do you think he was happy about it? Or do you think he felt a bit manipulated, made to roll over, sit up, play alive? I know just how he felt. A few years ago, I was told to prepare to die. So I did. I looked into my heart, tore open my soul, faced both the beautiful and the ugly truths inside myself. I began every day by asking, if I knew I was going to die at midnight, what would I do today? And that's how I lived. The paradox was that it made me happy, made me feel vibrantly alive, perhaps for the first time ever. Then I was given new medications and told to prepare to live. So I did, even though the drugs made me sicker than my disease ever had. I went back to doing what I thought I should do, rather than what I wanted to do. I bought into our society's intoxicating myth that death comes only for others. I rolled over, sat up, played alive. The paradox was that it made me uncomfortable, made me sadder than when I was dying. Last month, with the side effects from my drugs making me more and more miserable, I came to my senses again. I stopped taking my medications. My friends who aren't infected with HIV can't understand it. My friends with AIDS and cancer understand only too well. Quality over quantity. Better to live better rather than longer. I suppose I could live for years if I took all the drugs that make me feel like I would rather be dead. Instead, I'm shamelessly happy, embarrassingly productive, and love my life more than ever. I think of Lazarus a lot these days, sitting there on his porch, watching the sun ease across the desert sky, waiting for the hoopla to die down so he could go back to what he knew best. I have learned the lesson of Lazarus and strive hard every day to remember it. I carry a string of prayer beads with me now and say this mantra all day long. I am living, I am dying. I am living, I am dying. This paradox I can live with. This paradox I understand.
For the thing which I greatly feared is come upon me, and that which I was afraid of is come unto me. I was not in safety, neither had I rest. Neither was I quiet. Trouble came.
And Trouble Came, an African AIDS diary. Jackie Sullivan was a heroin addict and prostitute. she worked the streets of New York City's Lower East Side. Producer Dave Isay of Sound Portraits Productions lived on one of those streets. The two became friends. In 1994, Jackie resolved to get off drugs and stop hustling. She wanted to pull her life together so that one day she could reunite with her son, Butchie. She'd left him as a baby with his grandmother. Jackie was HIV positive. She knew she might never see her son in person. So hours after getting out of jail a final time, she began recording him audio messages. Together with Dave Isay, they made these, Letters to Butchie.
Hi, Butchie. I know it's been a long time. Yeah, you're probably wondering, like, who is this person, like, calling me Hi, Butchie? This is your mother. And I think at the age you are right now, I believe you know of me. But I haven't been in your life for about over 7 years now. And I just want to leave something to you and maybe fill in the gaps to some of the questions you might have that maybe you don't know now answers to.
This was our routine, Butchie. It was just me and you the whole day, every, you know, Monday through Friday. I would try and dress us the same way. You know, like if I was wearing a red T-shirt, you would wear a red T-shirt. And we'd go in the stroller and we would usually walk along 86th Street. And you were so handsome. People used to, like, stop and have to admire you and, like, oh, my God, he's so beautiful. Like, you know, every mother hears that. But I felt like you were the most handsomest thing God created. And I used to just like to walk around with you. I was proud.
Drugs was 24/7 on my mind, unfortunately. I always refer to the $6 million man. As I shot up so much drugs, I said my arm's got to be worth at least $1 million. So I left you at Grandma's house on 25th Avenue. You were 13 months old. You were sitting on the kitchen table, and you were wearing a little baby blue outfit that said Blue Boy on it that Dorothy had bought for you. It was one of my favorite outfits. And you were just sitting on the table, and me and Grandma had a little disagreement that night, and I used it as an excuse to get out of the house, and I never came back.
Hi, Butchie. Today's Friday, November 4th, and it happens to be a very special day because today's your birthday. It officially became your birthday at 3:51 p.m. That's the exact time that I gave birth to you. And 9 years ago, at this minute, I was lying in a hospital bed, exhausted, but so happy to have you in my life.
So you're going to be 9 years old, my son, my baby, 9 years old. God, you really are. Growing up to be a big, strong, healthy, good-looking kid. And I know that you have the utmost respect for family, and you have manners, and just keep it up like that. Try not to ever hurt anybody. Especially the way I hurt you. So like I said, have a very, very happy birthday. And hope next year I'm with you, blowing out the 10 candles on the birthday cake. I miss you a lot, and I love you. Happy birthday.
How you doing, sweetheart? We're November 14th, I believe, a week before Thanksgiving.
I got a picture of you today. I don't know why I'm crying. Me and Grandma have been talking a lot more lately than we have in the past couple of years. I've made a promise not only to Grandma, but to myself, not to come into your life until I'm stable, and I won't leave you again. That's why it's taken so long to come back to you, because I have to really, really be sure. So the next time you see me, you're going to just have to get sick of seeing me, because I won't leave. And it makes me feel really, really good, even though I'm hysterical crying. Each day is a day closer to coming back into your life. I don't know how much longer I might be alive, But I'm going to see you before I go away. It's New Year's Eve, and I have no great plans for tonight. The old lady's just going to stay home. She doesn't feel good. She'll just contemplate, watch the ball fall, remember the times at Grandma's house, all the good times. We used to always bring in the New Year with Guy Lombardo. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Happy New Year. And everybody would go wild. And it was so much fun. I just want to wish you a Happy New Year. And maybe next year we'll celebrate together. I'm not going to promise you, but I'll try. I want you to know that I love you very much. And I hope to see you before I leave this world. Have a good night, sweetheart. I love you.
Jackie Sullivan stayed drug-free for 3 years, then died of pneumonia in 1997. She never met her son again. Letters to Butchie was edited by Gary Covino. Technical supervisor was Kirill Wheeler. The music was by Nick Drake. Producers were David Isay and Stacey Abramson of Sound Portraits Productions, on the web at soundportraits.org. I'm Joe Richman of radiodiaries.org. Links to all the producers you heard in this hour are at hearingvoices.com.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. Our producers are Scott Carrier, Ann Hepperman, Larry Massett, and Kara Oler. Our intern is Max Darum. Mix engineer is Robin Wise of soundimagery.com. Executive producer is Barrett Golding. From NPR, National Public Radio, this is HearingVoices.com.